Hi, everyone. This is Sean Gunn from Gilmore Girls and Guardians of the Galaxy, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hey there, funny book fans. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I am your host, Joe Stuber. And this is the place where you can tune in each and every week to hear those cool conversations with tremendously talented folks who bring our favorite comic book characters to life. If you're streaming the show at the website or you've downloaded it from the website, comicbookcentral.net, or if you've subscribed in iTunes, you're getting it that way, or subscribed in Blueberry, if you're streaming it on Stitcher, if you've clicked the link on Facebook or Twitter, however you're hearing the show, I am so glad you have joined us today. Big show coming up. As many of you listeners know, over the summer, I attended Terrificon in Connecticut. Great show. Love it. That's where I got a chance to chat briefly with Guardians of the Galaxy's Sean Gunn. You might have heard on that episode where Sean was telling me about his castmate Michael Rooker's antics on the set of the new Guardians flick. Our conversation... That brief conversation was back on episode 142. After I recorded that, Sean mentioned to me that he would be up for an in-depth interview right here on Comic Book Central. That is happening today. Of course it is. So I wanted to get this episode online a few days earlier than usual. Usually we're on Saturday. Wanted to get it to you a few days earlier because in today's conversation, we're going to be chatting about a very popular television show that's returning in a big, big way, Gilmore Girls. Okay, the series is returning for 4 episodes. It's going to be on Netflix Friday, November 25th. We're previewing it today. So if you're listening to this interview after that date, it's out there. It's on Netflix. Go get it. The whole series is out there. Seven seasons, all the episodes, everything's out there. So after today's show, go watch them all. You can binge watch Gilmore Girls. So Gilmore Girls, Guardians of the Galaxy, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, other stuff that Sean's involved in that doesn't have double G's in. We're going to get to a lot today. So as usual, let's go get a little bit more background on my special guest in the lair. And then you are going to hear from the man himself, Sean Gunn. Sean Gunn was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri, where he graduated from St. Louis University High School. Following a move to Chicago, he graduated from DePaul University's theater school, and while in Chicago, he helped start a theater company, landed some acting gigs, and then decided to make the move to Los Angeles. Numerous television guest roles followed, but one in particular lasted a bit longer than just an episode or two. In 2000, Sean appeared as DSL installer Mick in the second episode of the quirky CW comedy drama Gilmore Girls.
You live here?
Yes, I do.
I'm supposed to install a DSL for Lorelai Gilmore. Is that you?
Yes, that's me.
I'm Mick.
Hi, Mick. Nice to meet you. Could you get off my porch?
I was told that you wouldn't be here, but to look for a ceramic frog with a key in it.
I don't understand.
We can't find the frog.
I didn't order a DSL.
The order was placed by an Emily Gilmore.
Oh, no.
We would have been done by now, but the frog search has put us way behind.
It turns out Sean's crazy character was a perfect fit alongside the residents of Stars Hollow. He was renamed Kirk Gleason, and he quickly became a fan favorite on the show, and he appeared in 137 episodes throughout the show's amazing seven-season run. Now, at various times throughout his career, Sean has teamed up with his brother, writer-director James Gunn. Now, for us comic book fans, those team-ups didn't get any bigger than 2014's Guardians of the Galaxy, the smash hit based on characters from Marvel Comics. With James at the helm of the big-budget Marvel sci-fi superhero flick, Sean took on a couple of roles. He was the on-set Rocket Raccoon, which later became a CGI character voiced by actor Bradley Cooper. And he appears on screen as Kraglin, one of the Ravagers and first mate of Yondu, played by Michael Rooker. And Guardians turned out to be a ginormous success. Audiences packed theaters to the tune of over $750 million at the worldwide box office. In May, Sean, Michael, and the rest of the Ravagers will return to menace the Guardians of the Galaxy. But before that happens, we are definitely going to see more of Kirk Gleason as Sean and his castmates return to Stars Hollow for the long-awaited Gilmore Girls revival on Netflix. And joining me today is a talented actor who, over the next several months, will be revisiting two of his most memorable characters. Let's welcome in Sean Gunn. Sean, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Joe.
Thanks for being here today. Thanks for chatting with me at Terrificon this summer. I really appreciate it. How have you been since we last spoke? How was your summer?
My summer has been pretty good, quite busy. I've been traveling around a great deal. I'm doing a lot of promotion for the new Gilmore Girls reboot that's coming out.
I was going to say, when we spoke over the summer, you mentioned that you had done that. It's here. I'm guessing this is something fans of yours have been asking about for what, close to a decade now? Is it? Can that be possible?
Yeah, that's true. We wrapped this show originally in 2007, so it's been 9 years.
Man.
And on Black Friday, on November 25th, we launched these four new episodes. Each one's an hour and a half long, so it's four new pieces of content on Netflix. And it was very exciting. It's been cool to step back in there and check it out.
Yeah, speaking of summer, this is Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life, so it's going the four seasons, right? You got four episodes, four seasons?
Correct.
Okay, and so that's going to be
winter,
coming up.
Spring, summer, and fall.
We're going to be talking about Gilmore Girls. We're going to be talking about, it's Comic Book Central. I've got to ask you about Guardians of the Galaxy, too.
Of course.
We're going to be chatting about some of these things. I want to go back a little bit, though, and find out what kind of kid a young Sean Gunn was. What were you into? What were your inspirations? Were it toys, sports, TV, movies, comics?
Yeah, that's, I think, a lot of things. I was definitely more of an indoor kid than an outdoor kid. Not that I didn't go outside, but I did, I was into movies, and I was always a huge baseball fan. Some of my brothers and I were really into baseball, and I read a lot of baseball history and would, pore over statistics and things like that. But I also love music and movies. I grew up in suburban, in the suburbs of St. Louis.
Yes, yes. Are you a Cardinals fan?
Big time.
Okay.
Big time Cardinals fan. In the blood. Like it's, when you're from anywhere around St. Louis, that's sort of just, it's in your bloodstream that you become a diehard Cardinal fan. I was a big Cardinal fan. I mean big, like listen to every single game on the radio.
Oh, fan. Wow. Okay. So So you can, cause most people are like, baseball's boring and you watch it and it's when you're there at the game, it's awesome. But to even listen on the radio, you've got to be hardcore fan.
Oh, for years and years and years, we followed every single game. We'd either listen on the radio, watch on TV, probably went to 15 or 20 games a year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Most of the years growing up, big time Cardinal
favorite
fan.
Player?
But I, favorite player?
Yeah.
Willie McGee. Willie McGee.
There you go.
Willie Dean McGee.
There you go.
1985 MVP award winner. we were really into movies and stuff in my family too. I had older brothers, obviously. One of my brothers is probably known by a lot of your listeners. But
yeah, I think we'll talk about him pushing you around a little bit on set.
Yeah, we'll talk about him a little later.
You have four brothers and a sister?
I have four brothers and a sister. That's right. I'm the youngest of six.
Wow.
And less than 8 years separates the six of us. So we're all totally close in age. And I think that in a lot of ways, even though we were all really social and had a lot of friends our own age as well, our family in some ways was our own little community of people. I mean, I always had good friends, but I also always kind of hung out with my siblings as much or more than any of my friends. So we were real tight in my family.
Do you
think
being from such a large family that may have influenced the acting? Like maybe like I've got to get attention or I've got to get some attention over here because all my mom and dad's attention is going in other directions. Could that have had something to do with it? Or am I just, do I have you on the couch for no reason?
No, I appreciate that question, and I think that there's probably some truth to that. I know that I always wanted to be an actor from the time I was was old enough to know what a profession was, and I think that there was an element of it that I wanted to be heard. So when you're a little, you know, when you're a little kid, but I liked being the center of attention. I liked it when I would speak up and everybody in the room would stop and look at me, you know. I was a born performer. I liked the limelight, and I think over the years it changed a little bit, but that you're onto something there, my desperate starving for attention was somehow manifest in my acting career.
Nothing's changed, right? It stays the same, right?
Yeah.
There's always this desperate acting for it. Exactly. Okay. So out of college, you start a theater company?
Oh, that's true.
How do you do that? Like, that seems like a huge thing a huge undertaking there.
Well, all we really did was just start putting on shows. I mean, I went to an acting conservatory, the Goodman School of Drama in Chicago. And it was this weird thing where after we graduated, me and a couple of my friends from school fell into this situation where there was an empty coffee shop next to an independent movie theater, and then with a black box theater for plays in the basement, and we sort of took this leap of faith and opened this coffee shop and started a theater company at the same time. We were very good, I think, at running a theater company and not so good at running a coffee shop, which should come as no surprise. None of us we all had acting degrees, not business degrees. So the coffee shop actually didn't last very long. But it's still there. It's called the Chopin in Chicago. But we started this theater company where we just started putting on plays, and I was actually directing at that time. I was at a period in my life right around when I was like 22, 23, when I just gotten out of school. I had a little brief period where I thought that directing theater was really where my future was going to be. Now it didn't go that direction for me for many reasons, but I miss it. I'd still love to go direct some theater, you know?
Do you prefer, I mean, I've asked this of other actors too, and I know there are huge differences, but do you prefer stage work over film and television work, or do you just, I mean, it's completely different animal.
It is a completely different animal. And as much as you'd like to, you know, divorce the question from the fact that you can make a living doing one, and it's much harder to make, I mean, they're both hard to make a living to do, but you know, the fact that I can make a decent living working in film and television, and then it's such a grind to do that in theater. It just has to be part of the question. You kind of can't just dismiss that part of it. Yeah. But I love all of them. I love all three media, film, television, and theater, when the material is good, and when the work is good, and when people care about what they're doing. I think a lot of theater actors tend to think that they have a monopoly on that in the theater, but I don't think that's true. I actually think they're just, you know, they're just as many terrible plays as there are terrible movies.
There's room for all of them, right?
Yeah, exactly. But you know, you start out in the theater and you see how hard it is to get people just in the door to see your shows, and how hard it is to be viable, you know, to keep your theater company up and running, much less for you all to make a living off of doing it. And that was the thing that really convinced me to move to LA was that I was doing these plays that I was really proud of, but that you know, not that many people were seeing. And then I do these commercials, you know, I did a commercial for the Illinois Lottery and millions of people see it. It's something I'm not particularly proud of. I mean, I'm not embarrassed by it, but it's not, you know, the kind of work I want to be doing. And I sort of put those things together and say, there's got to be a way to, there's got to be a way to do both these things. There's got to be a way to do work that I am proud of, but that a lot of people see and puts food on my table. And the only way to do that is to go to LA and try to get into, you know, film and TV.
Well, you mentioned coffee shop. I think that can segue into one of your more famous roles. Can it?
Okay.
Kurt Gleason. Sure. Okay, look, full disclosure. Yeah. I'm going to be completely honest. I've seen Guardians of the Galaxy a billion times. I've not seen Gilmore Girls. I'm sorry. I apologize to all those who are listening to this.
You're not exactly the demographic, Joe. It's okay.
Probably not. Probably not. But I will say this.
And you certainly don't need to apologize. I always think when people apologize for not seeing it, I always think, what kind of a jerk would I have to be to be like, how dare you not have watched my show? How dare you have not watched every television show that's ever existed?
If it makes you feel any better, no, I did pull in a sidekick on this one. A friend of mine, Caitlin, she's having a Gilmore Girls watch party November 25th. By the way, she wants to know if you could show up if you're going to be in Columbus, Ohio, November 25th. You've got a place to watch it.
Oh, yeah, I don't think I'll be in Columbus, but if I am, I'll look up Caitlin, I promise you.
There you go. There's a line in the new trailer for A Year in the Life. It says, one of the characters says about your character, explain to me who this person is. And then, oh, that I could. I kind of felt
oh,
that way.
That
can you explain this character to us?
I think that Kirk defies explanation. So if I, you know, if I'm speaking to your listeners who have never seen the show, I would say give it a shot. Even if you think it's just a chick show, you might like it. Not everyone does. I'm not saying it's for everyone. It is an acquired taste for sure. But it is an unusual, it's not your normal, you know, sort of schmaltzy sitcom-y show. There's tons of cultural references and really fast-paced dialogue. It's old school in a way.
Okay, that was one of the questions that Caitlin had regarding the dialogue. So I want to kind of reference that. She had mentioned about, because you mentioned, she says it's full of fast-paced, witty dialogue, pop culture references, like you mentioned. She wanted to know, did these longer-than-average scripts allow you room to improvise your lines in certain scenes?
The answer to that is the most emphatic no I could ever get. We had, you know, the general rule of thumb on television is that it's around a page a minute. Now, we did 41 minutes per episode. The major networks were 42, but we were 41. We had one more minute of commercials. That's a boring tidbit. But we had 41 minutes per episode, and we generally had 80-page scripts. So we were working at almost twice the rate of any other show on television. We shot 8 days, so we shot over 10 pages a day for, you know, 7 years. If you work in the industry, that's insane. But I can tell you that in those years, not a syllable was improvised. Mm-hmm. Everything is exactly 100% word perfect to the letter as it was written on the script. That's the way the creator, Amy Sherman-Palladino, writes. That's the way she wanted it. Those of us on the show who got that, we got it. I mean, you know, you could gripe and complain if you wanted to, but it wasn't going to do you any good. If you didn't get the line perfect, we had to do it again. It's a really sort of unusual and I think cool thing about the show. I think it's one of the reasons the show has had real lasting power and that people love it to this day is that it's very meticulous. It's very, you know, precise and it was written with a very specific voice in mind.
I got to go to my sidekick.
It really works.
I got to go to my sidekick here for another question here. She mentioned your impressive resume on the show, or Kirk's impressive resume. Swan Delivery mm-hmm. Man to Hey There Beauty yep. Product Salesman. Okay, I'm going to have to watch it. I know all the episodes are on Netflix. I'm going to have to go back and binge. She wants to know about your most memorable job on the show.
I really love, gosh, a lot of my most memorable episodes are ones where I'm not working. There's an episode where I play Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof, and there's an episode where I play Jesus with children, Joe. It's me as Tevye with all 8-year olds.
Let me write this down. Hold on. Let me write this down.
Oh, it's wonderful.
I got work
Jews
to do.
And Chinese Food is the name of the episode. That's it's probably my favorite all time episode of the show too.
Okay.
And then there's like an episode where I play Jesus in the Festival of Living Art, where we do the it's a real thing down in Orange County. They do these live representations of paintings, and okay. Kirk plays Jesus in the Last Supper, and it starts to go to his head, and he starts walking around and acting like he's Jesus.
Oh no!
It's really wonderful. But,
yeah, no wonder you can't explain this character to me. Yeah,
I know. If I'm going to give a job, I'm going to say the hockey announcer. I was an announcer at a hockey game, and it was great fun because it's something that I think I would have liked to have done in my actual life. So
okay.
That's one. Yeah,
I got my work cut out for me here. No, I got to binge watch before the end of the month. I got to check these out. All right. Look, yeah. Something I do know a little bit about Guardians of the Galaxy. Man, okay, you got a bunch mm-hmm. of things going on here. We got Kraglin, your live action.
Yep.
On that, your Rocket. So you're Rocket Raccoon. You're the initial stand-in. We're going to talk a little bit about what you did there. Also, it's mentioned a stand-in for Thanos, but did you do anything with Thanos, or was it just Rocket specifically?
Okay. First of all, just to correct you for a second, what I do is not stand-in work. There is a stand-in for Rocket and for Thanos. Those are different people.
Okay, that's stand-ins are Artie Shaw who actress Artie Shaw.
Yeah,
I think was
yeah, Artie Shaw did some of it, but okay. Actually, mostly. For the most part, Rocket stand-in is actually a little stuffed animal.
Okay.
stand-ins are there when the lighting crew is setting up lighting. That's what they're
okay.
there
yeah,
for.
Yeah, because I want to talk about motion reference
not,
and motion
that's
capture.
That's not what I do.
Right. I want to talk about motion
yeah,
reference
I
and motion capture.
I actually play Rocket. Right. I actually play Rocket on set.
Okay.
So I actually am there, and there's a whole team of people that go into creating the character of Rocket. And I'm one of those, I'm a member of that team. So basically I work with the VFX team. I sort of get my body down to where it needs to be. And I interact with the other actors in the scene when we shoot it originally. The VFX team then uses my face generally, and sometimes my hands and, you know, shoulders as motion reference for Rocket.
We see in behind the scenes, you're like in a full body suit.
I did on the first movie. I did in the second movie. First to answer your question about Thanos, I did play Thanos on set as well in the first movie, but that was really just a day where basically
okay.
I'm standing on a forklift and I'm delivering lines in place of Josh Brolin, who then comes in and does them in post. I'm really just there to sort of read with the actors.
Okay.
It's not a big job.
No, I've seen this reference. That's why. Yeah. Cause Rocket, we see you like, I mean, you're like squatting around
yeah.
and you're like grabbing a machine
totally.
Gun. Yeah. Yeah. You're doing all kinds of stuff.
Totally. 100%. And what I do, motion reference is subtly different from motion capture, only in that they're not, I don't wear one of the suits with all the little lighted, you know, balls on it because a raccoon is too different from a human being to do all that digitally. So if you're playing, say, an ape in Planet of the Apes, or if you're playing Gollum in Lord of the Rings, those characters are very humanoid. So you can put the balls on a human face.
Yeah, we see Andy Serkis, and they put all those in.
Exactly.
And he actually, like, they morph
exactly.
him into the character. Okay.
Right. What I do is more reference for the animators so that they're using my face as a guideline for how Rocket's face is going to work. And for those who are really interested in the technology, actually, even Andy Serkis, most of what he does is actually also motion reference. Hmm. They just also have the, they have the added benefit that they can also do the motion capture digitally. They can do both. But with a raccoon, you can't do the, you just, the technology's not there.
I guess it's good you don't have a raccoon face. I guess that's the good part.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I, you know, basically my job there is to sort of prepare to play Rocket as I do any other role that I play. You know, I learn the lines and I act the scenes with the actors, but with the knowledge that it's not really, it's not all or even mostly going to end up on screen. It's going to be sort of a rough draft of where the character is. You know, it's sort of a rough draft for the first assembly of the cut of the film that the animators can start to use to build like the facial reactions of the character. And that then the actor who plays the role, Bradley Cooper, can come in and ultimately really breathe full life into the character and just sort of, and put all of the pieces together. So it's a, you know, it's an important role, but we were learning on the job. I mean, my brother James, who, as you know, wrote and directed the movie, he asked me to do it for the first film, knowing that he trusted me as an actor, knowing that we worked together well, and but not exactly knowing how it was going to all work. It was like, I need an actor to play Rocket on set because I don't want, you know, I don't want just somebody just standing off camera reading from a, you know, reading from a page. I want a real actor in there with them to really make it seem as realistic as possible. And so he asked me to do it. At first we didn't know that I was going to do anything physically. He thought that I might actually be off screen the whole time and just using my voice. But when we started rehearsals, I was like, let me just try this. And I actually used some of my acting training.
Right then. You came up with that during production.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay. We didn't talk about that at Terrificon. So, okay. That's interesting.
No. And I honestly, Joe, I don't even know if tons of people know that, but that's how it worked. It was, you know, it was like we started rehearsals with the idea that, okay, Sean, you're going to read Rocket, you know, in these scenes. And I started reading it and I was like, why don't I just get in there and do it? And so, you know, I drew on some of my acting training where we learned how to mimic animals and stuff. And I'm very, very limber and I'm just sort of skinny and my body folds up very easily. And so I literally just got down on my hands and knees and got to where sort of Rocket would be in these scenes. And we started rehearsing them and that's what worked. And that was what really was like, oh wow, this is really, you know, having a person there is really helpful.
Well, that's what I wanted to know. What feedback were you getting from the actors at that point? Because a lot of times we see films and we watch these behind the scenes things and they're talking to a tennis ball on a stick or some point of reference.
Right.
What feedback were you getting from your brother and from the other actors in that was giving them something to play off of?
I mean, I think it's, I think that it's vital, to those scenes that I was, that they had somebody real to get in there and do it. You're exactly right. The tennis ball and a stick is what we were trying to avoid. We didn't want to, you know, my brother didn't want, Chris and Zoe and Dave talking to a tennis ball and a stick. He wanted them talking to an actor. And so I think that I learned very quickly and I'm incredibly humbled by this, but it's true that the other actors, and at any time when it was possible, they would say, we want Sean in there. It's more helpful to us if he's there. And from my point of view, that's why I was there to begin with. I was not there to play the role. I was there for them. I'm there so that Chris Pratt and Zoe Saldana and Dave Bautista, et cetera, are talking to an actor, you know, that they're not having to imagine
something in their head for what the, for what's happening there. It's something I take a lot of pride in because it really reinforced my idea that acting is ultimately sort of a form of giving, you know, that you're there to give something to an audience, or in this case, to give something to the other actors. And I don't want to overstate how much I did because, like I said, I'm just a member of the team. You know, the VFX supervisor was my sort of my second director. On the first movie, you know, it ended up being on both movies, but I would consult the VFX director, who would say, this would be more helpful if you pick this up or look this way or whatever it was that they had to do that would help them in post. And I was there to help the other actors. So if I could do anything for them, but then that it sort of starts to go away. And then in the course of post-production, my performance gets increasingly sort of extracted as the character gets fleshed out in the visual effects. And then Bradley, you know, breathes full life into the character.
I was kind of interested in that, like how much of what you did actually gets through to the final product. And also if you could give us some insight into that really emotional scene you have with Dave Bautista at the end, after the battle. Cause I remember the first time I saw the movie, I just thought, wow, they made me care about a CG raccoon. I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little bit of insight? Yeah. Into that?
Yeah. And that scene at the end of the movie, it's funny you mentioned that. And I'm glad that stuck with you, because I got to say it's a question from time to time. It's the most annoying question that I get from fans. And I love fans. I love talking to them. So I forgive them for asking, but a lot of times people will say to me, how hard was it to keep a straight face at the end of the movie when Bautista is petting you? And I'm like, keep a straight face? Are you kidding? I'm literally crying in that scene.
Yeah, you watch the behind the scenes and you're like full on ugly cry. And I was like, whoa, that's why I think sold it. But I'm wondering, yeah, okay. But did you have any inspirations, or where did you go to sort of channel that in amongst all the green spandex and, you know, sci-fi stuff?
You know, Joe, that's my job. And so it was an acting job. And it's like by the end of that was something that we shot towards the end, of the process. So I had lived with Rocket for months, and I knew his story. And I had already, you know, I already done the scene where he says, I didn't ask to be this. I didn't ask to be put together, you know, taken apart and put together like a little monster. I'd played that scene already, and I knew how hard it was. And I also knew that I had heard my brother say that Rocket is the loneliest character he had ever written before, you know, that he is, and that he's a character that almost more than any other is really driven by loneliness. And the one beacon in that fog of loneliness is Groot. And so that's where I am. That's what I'm thinking about when I'm sitting there. And, you know, and it's a terribly painful moment for Rocket. So all of the bells and whistles of yeah, but you're wearing this green jumpsuit and you look ridiculous, you know, and you're squatting on the ground and you've got Dave Bautista next to you. Anything about it that's ridiculous is I'm not thinking about any of that, because that's not my job. My job is to be where the character is, you know? And so that's a really warm moment I have from shooting. And I'm really proud of it. I'm proud of that scene. Dave Bautista is one of the greatest, warmest human beings I've ever known in my life. And I'm proud that we've gotten to be friends. And I was happy to be there for him in that scene. Cause it's not about me. I don't end up on screen. Some people know I did it. Some don't. That's not important to me. What is important is that Dave is right there, that he's living as Drax comforting Rocket. That's what's important to me. And so I think, you know, I think we pulled that off.
Yeah, mission accomplished, because like I said, it's one of my favorite scenes in the film, and man, everybody involved sells it. It's just, I did not see it coming, nor did I expect it. I didn't, yeah. The other character you have in this, now we get to see you. Mm-hmm. So if we're not sure where you are for Rocket, now we get to see you as Kraglin. You didn't really have much in the way of comic book research for the character, though, did you?
No. In fact, if you look up Kraglin in the Marvel Wiki, he's just like a black and white... I don't even know what that creature is. All I can say is that I was very grateful not to have to put on makeup to make me look like that. I know that in the first movie, my brother has had a habit of killing me in many films and projects that we've done over the years. Watching me die, I think, is a secret thrill that he enjoys.
Back on the couch with the Gunn brothers.
Exactly. So I think that I was very happy when I read the first Guardians and I saw that A, I wasn't an hour's worth of makeup, and B, my character survived the end of the film. I thought that was really great.
He must have felt bad for
you. But you know, Kraglin is an interesting character, and I can tell you that in the second movie we'll get to know a little bit more about Kraglin and sort of what makes him tick.
Okay, because with the first one, you got to set up all the characters, you got to set up the universe, and everybody, I mean, it's kind of going six ways to Sunday. That's what I was curious about. Are we going to get to see more backstory of the Ravagers and Kraglin in the new one?
Well, I can say this about Kraglin. I can say that when the film ends, and the second movie picks up just a couple of months after the first movie ends in time. And I can tell you that the whole idea that Yondu may have just sort of accepted this portrayal by Peter Quill, when he does not give them the stone and pulls a fast one on him, you know, he gives Yondu the troll instead. That doesn't really sit well with Kraglin. So I think that as the movie starts, Kraglin is wondering why Yondu has not been more fervent in going after Peter. And then we'll explore some of that in the second movie.
Okay. So we will get to delve in a little bit more into that sort of right-hand man aspect.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's going to be nice.
Yeah. A little bit. Yeah.
In the first movie, cause I know your brother kind of came in, there was a first draft of the script and I know it had gone through a couple things and your brother came in and I guess kind of rewrote a lot of it. Was Kraglin in that first script, or did your brother James add that character in and sort of flesh that out for you?
I have no idea. I know that, I read no versions of the script until the one that my brother had overhauled.
Okay.
So I don't know if Kraglin existed in the first version of the script or not. I do know that he had me in mind when he was writing it, but not knowing for sure, because even, you know, he's the director, but it was a huge project. He had never obviously had such a big job before. And so, you know, Marvel had to really vet and okay everybody that was in the movie. So to the best of my knowledge, he wrote that character hoping that I would be able to play it, but not knowing 100% sure that I would. And then fortunately I was able to do it. Yeah.
What was that like for both of you? And cause I know for him, like you just referenced him coming in, you guys had done a lot of stuff, going back to some short films, to some television series and things like that. But what was it like for both of you coming into a project that big? There's no way you could have had something that big to compare it to before that. Cause the Marvel universe is its own thing.
Well, I have two responses to that. The first is that it was a heck of a lot more. He had a heck of a lot more on the line than I did. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just a Joe Schmo actor. That movie can bomb, and nobody really.
You're still getting Gilmore Girls.
Exactly. I can move on to my next project. It's much different for him if he makes, you know, if he makes Pluto Nash. You know, then
nice
then it's really incredibly detrimental to his career.
Deep
so
cut.
it's So you know, it's, I was always sensitive to the fact that our, as much as we like working together, and we, you know, we've been working together in different capacities our whole lives, the stakes were much, much higher for him, and his job was, you know, magnificently different than mine was. But I will say personally, it was great. Like, I was super, I was so incredibly proud of him and grateful to be on set. And I had this sort of flash, you know, we had done this old, this B movie called Romeo and Juliet, that some of your fans might know from the mid 90s. Just, you know, the production office was like a walk up in Hell's Kitchen, tiny little room with a bulletin board on the wall. It was hot and stuffy. And then cut to years later, walking into the production office for Guardians of the Galaxy, this massive budget movie, and seeing all of the artwork and the, you know, the animatics and the visual representations of what we were going to do. But thinking to myself, this is really just the same thing. It is really just, you know, we're people coming together to try to tell a story. And yes, the scale is 100 times larger, but the task is the same. You know, you try to make a movie as well as you can, put as much of yourself as you can into it, do it with love, and tell a great story. That never changes, no matter how big the movie is or how large your budget is, you know?
Slightly bigger budget than the first time the Gunn brothers worked with raccoons and superheroes, Sparky and Michaela.
Oh gosh. Yeah. That's okay. True.
Just checking. I was wondering if that was an inspiration at all, but,
Sparky and Michaela, gosh, that was fun.
Well, there's raccoons in it. You're the Ravagers. That's basically your inner circle there, isn't it? That's all your buddies. Most of them.
Yeah. A lot of them are, and the ones that I didn't know already have become my buddies. So, yeah.
Favorite moment on
absolutely.
Set? Favorite moment on set as you and your buddies are getting to just play in one of the biggest playgrounds on the planet?
Oh, gosh. What is my favorite moment on set? I mean, from the second movie, I do remember, you know, there's, I don't know. I don't know how much I can't say that much.
It must involve Rooker then if you're going there.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, no, that's true. Rooker showing his ass, that's always my least favorite moment.
You told me about him dropping his pants at some point, so we talked about that.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Still,
yeah,
your favorite. Apparently still your favorite. I guess it just, you can't shake that image, can you?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, fair enough. Look, when this movie came out, this was not a sure thing for Marvel. I mean, obviously, you know, the first Iron Man, that was kind of a roll of the dice, and then everything after that was just, they knew it was going to blow up big. This was probably the riskiest thing that they had coming out. Before the premiere, what conversations were you having with your brother about this, and maybe like the weeks before it premiered? Because nobody had any idea this was going to blow up the way it did.
No one had any idea. I will say that by the weeks before, you know, by two weeks, 4 weeks before, we had a there was a lot of pretty strong indicators that the movie was going to do fairly well. I don't think we ever thought that it was going to do as well as it did. Partially because you can never anticipate the multiple viewers that we had, which was amazing. But I had a feeling, okay, I think this is not going to be a bomb, you know, that the test audiences that were just like, you know, a month out, 2 months out for the release were really, really strong. So I think by then we had a pretty good feeling, but you know, I don't know. I always think that I was almost more optimistic about the movie than just about anybody involved with it. I think that my brother knew that he had put his heart and soul into it, but he wasn't sure how audiences were going to respond. I'm sure he was feeling better by a month or two out, but 6 months before or a year before, he certainly had no idea. I think Chris Pratt felt the same way. He knew that he loved it and had put his heart into it, but he didn't know, you know? And I just always had this really good feeling about it. I knew how good the script was. I could see that Marvel and Disney were putting real effort into promoting it. You know, they weren't burying it. So we knew that. And I just have a tremendous amount of faith in my brother. I know how talented he is, and I knew he was exactly the right person to make this movie. So I just had a very good feeling that it was going to be, at least a nice little modest hit with a little, you know, with its niche audience that would really love it. I knew it would find some audience of people who really loved it. Now, obviously I didn't know it was going to be, such a monster success. That's insane. And that's something you can never really prepare for in your career. I mean, that's just like, that just either it happens or it doesn't, you know, I don't know how to predict things like that. You know,
what impressed you the most about the film while you were shooting it? And then when you saw the finished product?
The thing that impressed me the most while we were shooting it is the extent to which my brother James understood, saw the big picture of the whole thing before we even started, and then got all the other actors on that and you know, crew people and, you know, key members of the team, how he got everyone on the same page so that we all felt like we were making the same movie. You know, it's a tricky tone. It's not easy material, to get exactly right. And yet I think we really sort of threaded the needle in terms of knowing what type of movie we were making. That's what impressed me most, in making it, in viewing it. What impresses me most, I think, is how it is truly a film for all ages, the likes of which we almost never see in movies anymore. I think that it's a movie for children, grown-ups, and older people, in very emphatically. It's not like just a kid's movie that adults will like too, or a grown-up movie that can skew older in its demographic. It is really a movie that's for everyone. And what a magnificent thing that is to be a part of, you know.
Anything surprise you going from the first movie to the second movie?
I think that starting the second movie, I was a little worried about how the success of the first film would affect the movie and the actors in it. I was worried that, you know, that everyone would be maybe a little farther removed from their passion for it than they were the first time around. And the opposite was true. I think that it felt like coming home again. And the new additions on set, like Kurt Russell and Tom Clementieff and Chris Sullivan, in addition to Chris and Zoe and Dave and Rooker and Karen Gillan, you know, I think that it just really felt like a family on set, and there was just so much love for the project. I'm so excited for this movie. I'm so excited to see it, and so excited to share it with an audience, because I honestly believe that it felt like the best thing I had ever been a part of when we were making it. And I hope that, you know, some amount of that shines through, you know.
Anybody go fanboy with Kurt Russell around?
We all did. I mean, how can you not? Kurt Russell is just, he's a legend, and he's also incredibly down to earth and a nice dude, fun to be around. We all know he's a legend, you know. You just try to pretend, just try to act cool anyway, you know.
Any chance we might see Rom the Space Knight?
In the second movie?
Mm-hmm.
Or ever? Oh, I don't think I'm allowed to tell you.
Okay.
I don't think I'm allowed to tell you, but...
I thought I'd sneak one in. I thought maybe you had a few drinks in you. Maybe I could sneak one in there or something, so you never know.
Yeah, no, I know. I,
Late in the evening? I never know.
There will be some fun cameos for the, you know, there'll be some fun characters from the MCU people to enjoy, but I can't say who any of them are.
I'm hoping Howard the Duck makes a return. That's all I'm saying. Latest projects. We talked about Gilmore Girls. That's coming up. What else you got coming up that we can look forward to?
I also did this horror film called The Belko Experiment, which is another film that my brother James wrote and produced. Greg McLean, who directed Wolf Creek, directed it. And that comes out March 17th. It's a MGM Blumhouse production with Tony Goldwyn and John Gallagher Jr. and John C. McGinley and myself and Aria Arjona and a whole bunch of awesome actors. If you don't like violence, you probably want to sit that one out. But it's a nice bloody horror film, for fans of the genre to enjoy. We had a great reception at the Toronto Film Festival, and we're getting a nice release on March 17th. Guardians 2, of course, comes out May 5th. Gilmore Girls is November 25th. I'm busy promoting all those projects, going and meeting fans at various Comic Cons, and pounding the pavement, leading the actor's life, looking for my next job. Hoping for some good news soon.
Facebook, Twitter, Instagram?
Find me on Facebook. You can follow me on Facebook. Sean Gunn. My Twitter handle is at Sean Gunn. I'm at The Judge Gunn on Instagram, which is kind of my favorite of all the social media outlets. But yeah, that's it.
Well, I hope your brother doesn't kill you off in the horror movie. I hope he doesn't kill you off in Guardians. I hope you make it all the way to the end of those.
I know, Joe. I just hope I live.
Look, we hope you live too. I hope you make it to the end of Gilmore Girls. Hopefully your character makes it through that.
I appreciate it. I hope Kirk lives.
Yeah, I got to go binge watch some Gilmore Girls November 25th on Netflix. Guardians 2 May 5th next year. Always enjoy chatting with you, Sean. Thanks so much for joining me on Comic Book Central.
Sure thing, Joe. Thank you.
If you're like me and you have not seen Gilmore Girls, or if you're a fan of the show and you want to relive all the fun, put on a pot of coffee and binge watch to your heart's content. All 7 seasons are on Netflix right now. The 4-episode revival begins Friday, November 25th. Man, I got my work cut out for me. I got a lot of TV to watch. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, that opens May 5th next year. So looking forward to that. Sean Gunn, he is out there on social media. He's waiting for you to follow him. I will say he's pretty active on there too. I see him answering fan questions from time to time. So you're going to want to check out those sites if you haven't already. As always, you can find those links to his social media pages in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. Again, my thanks to Sean for stopping by and chatting with us today. Always nice to hear from him. And I definitely want to hear from you, each and every one of you listeners. Be sure to drop me a line, joe@comicbookcentral.net. Send me an email or click the Signal Me tab on the website. I want to find out what's on your mind. Man, what do you think? Are you a fan of Gilmore Girls? Do you love Guardians of the Galaxy? Also on the website, you can now leave a voicemail message, something new we're doing this year. You click it, record a message. Again, tell me what's on your mind. What do you think of Comic Book Central? Are there some guest ideas that you have? Yeah, send them in to me. I'm going to play those on the air. If you send them in, I'm going to play them right on the show. The website, comicbookcentral.net. That's where you're also going to find each and every episode of Comic Book Central in the archive. You go check them out. You want to check out my earlier chat with Sean Gunn or my conversation with Yondu himself, Michael Rooker. Those conversations, over 150 episodes, they are in the archive at the website. Go check them out there. You can also find each and every episode on iTunes. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. You get all the past episodes, and you're not going to miss a moment of what's coming up. A lot of good stuff ahead, too. So you're going to want to do that if you haven't already. If you're in iTunes, always appreciated if you just click on the review there. How many stars? Leave a review. Always appreciate that. You can also listen to Comic Book Central on Blueberry and Stitcher if you're not on iTunes. And if you haven't already, be sure to like the show on Facebook, follow it on Twitter, Share the Lair. Click share when I post the episodes each and every week. Retweet them on Twitter. A bunch of you out there doing that. I really appreciate that. There's so many I can count on each and every week. I know you're just clicking share on those episodes. So keep that going. Keep Comic Book Central Nation growing. I truly appreciate it. All right, kiddies, we are out of time for today. The next episode is going to be back on its regular day, Saturday. We're going from Gilmore Girls and Guardians to Gotham, because next week on Comic Book Central, I'm sitting down with the talented actor who portrays a young Bruce Wayne on the Fox hit TV series Gotham, David Mazouz. He's going to be here. Make sure you're back here with us. We are going to have a fantastic time here on the show. Until then, go binge watch you some Gilmore Girls. I know I'm going to do that. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the Lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content in this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 imported license. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, much like the Israelites of yore, the Stars Hollow Minutemen languished in the desert for 40 years. But tonight there was no promised land, no new Canaan. Only a humiliating 5-1 defeat at the merciless hands of the West Hartford Wildcats. So it's back to the desert for the Minutemen, perhaps for another 40 years. Of course, by then, I'll be 70 years old. A lot of the rest of you will probably be dead. Taylor, you'll be dead. Babette, Miss Patty, that man there in the hat.